Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's payments system reaches a make-or-break moment. A G20 hangover that no one planned for. A festive season spike in claims, but insurers won't pay for your mistakes. And why your next workplace should be closer to home. It's Tuesday, the 25th of November. South Africa's payments system is at something of a turning point. Global peers like India and Brazil have surged ahead with real-time interoperable platforms that have reshaped inclusion and economic growth. Here at home, PaySharp's early success and fresh signals from regulators are showing some momentum, but also I think a degree of hesitation. And industry leaders are warning that if South Africa doesn't accelerate collaboration, innovation and policy reform, it risks falling behind. So let's discuss the crossroads that we now face. I'm joined by Israel Skosana, Chief Product and Scheme Officer at PayInc, that's formerly BankServe Africa. It's an automated clearinghouse located here in Johannesburg and serving both national and Pan-African transactions. Israel, welcome back to the program. You frame all of this as South Africa's payments crossroads, direct quote. In strategic terms, what's the single biggest shift then that the country needs to make right now?
So the shift is happening, Jeremy. I think it's clear South Africa is entering one of the most important moments in its modern financial history. At the recent G20 discussions on cross-border payments where PayInc participated, there was a clear message that countries that modernize their payment systems will gain competitiveness, inclusion, and economic resilience. And then just weeks later after that session, the South African Reserve Bank acquired 50% of PayInc, so placing it amongst a small group of nations such as India, Brazil, Singapore that you mentioned, who treat digital payments as a sovereign infrastructure. So it's not an incremental reform, but rather a structural modernization that's currently underway.
You describe, though, South Africa's system, if I've read this correctly, as capable but hesitant. What, in your view, is causing that hesitation? And where's the bottleneck? Is it policy? Is it governance? Is it institutional culture? What is it?
So it's a combination of elements. One is we need to go back to the objective. The objective is to drive that financial inclusion, which then ensures that we have a reduction of the cost of doing payments within South Africa, which then results in economic activity and economic growth for South Africa. This can only be achieved through the collaboration that you talk about. It is banks, payment service providers, fintechs, regulators, and that's why the milestone of the establishment of the National Payments Utility through this co-governance with the South African Reserve Bank and commercial banks results in that utility for good coming through to drive that collaboration and ultimately delivering those objectives of economic growth.
But it's going to take some time before we start seeing quick benefit, is it not?
We must note, for example, we look at Egypt. Egypt took 5 years to get 50 million users of its faster payment system. In South Africa, our objective is to achieve way more than that in a shorter period of time. But it's through our history of strong financial services, our history of strong financial infrastructure, and collaboration that has taken place so that we can ensure that we achieve those objectives a lot sooner.
All right, so you point to Egypt as a continental success story. I'm assuming that you've had an opportunity to see India's UPI and Brazil's PIX up close. Are there lessons for South Africa that we need to urgently absorb, something that would maybe translate quickly here?
Exactly. And the UPI, for example, and all those countries that you've mentioned now, there was a material change in the mentality of how payments are seen. So it was not just about creating a payment system, but it was creating public infrastructure to meet those economic goals that the nation wanted to achieve. And hence, there was clear regulatory leadership coming through from those central banks to ensure that they participate in it. And that's why I say it's a small group of central banks, and the South African Reserve Bank is leading in that to say we will participate in building in that infrastructure to meet those economic objectives.
In this context, what does regulatory leadership actually mean?
It means the outcome is more inclusion, more competitiveness, higher economic participation, a lower cost of payments, and interoperability. That is governed in this case through the National Payments Utility to ensure that is achieved.
How difficult then is it for South Africa's banks and fintechs, and I guess the regulator as well, to commit to the kind of level of collaboration that you're referring to?
It means there's a shift that needs to take place from competition over the rails to competition over customer experience. At Payink, we're ensuring that the rails are available to all, and then that means that we can overlay the value adds that come through from those different users of the rails. So banks will still innovate on top of the shared, efficient, and national infrastructure, but it's the same as mobile networks sharing towers where everyone saves and the scalability is achieved.
Let's take this conversation from the theoretical then to the practical. What does a redesigned payment system actually look like in practice, Israel, for an SMME, for a retailer, for you and I, ordinary consumers?
So for the consumers, the story is a simple one. You should expect payment immediately. You should have a lower cost of doing payments. For an SMME, with that immediate payment, it results in cash flow, and not waiting multiple days for settlement to take place, the cost of payments reducing, and then the security that's associated with it. So it just opens up payments to all sooner than later.
So if South Africa fails to adapt at pace, what do you think the strategic risks are for, I guess, consumers, but for the broader economy and banks as well?
For the broader economy, Jeremy, I think it's that faster circulation of money, which will then obviously boost the GDP. There's obviously increased visibility of funds, more formalization. The example that we've given on the SMMEs, for example, moving from thin file clients where there's little record of their participation, becoming bankable, credit worthy businesses that then can get into the formal market. This is all possible through the digitization of payments and ultimately going again to deeper digital payments becoming a competitive advantage for South Africa at large, opposed to our full reliance on cash or our old legacy rails that we had in place.
All right. Finally, you say the cheese isn't moving back. Nice turn of phrase. What's the one decisive action that South Africa's payments ecosystem needs to take in the next year if we are to remain relevant?
Firstly, the move needs to take place where we are getting all payments service providers to hop onto the new payments rails. In this case, the PayShop, see growth there, parity of PayShop services across all the banks, across fintechs, to make sure that customers know how to do a PayShop transaction, customers enjoy the cost benefits of doing a PayShop transaction, enjoying the instant elements of PayShop coming through in that transaction, and then allowing for that adoption to take place where we see PayShop transactions taking place in merchants' environment just through the use of a QR code, for example. And that's the big change, where the future of South Africa's economy will depend on whether money can move cheaply, instantly, and fairly. And today, I think, you know, be it the Reserve Bank's acquisition of 50% of PayInc, the collaboration that's taking place with banks and fintechs is where we're making it very clear that South Africa is moving forward to make that future a reality.
Israel Skosana is Chief Product and Scheme Officer at PayInc. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, let's move now from banking to diplomacy, but let's stay with the money. And fair to say that South Africa did pull off the G20 spectacle at the weekend. But Ray Hartley from the Platform for African Democrats is warning that the real story begins now. Inflated spending, questionable contracts possibly, and almost no clarity on what the country actually gained. As you're about to hear, his argument is blunt. Once the limousines leave, South Africans, he's suggesting, are left washing the dishes. Ray, a very warm welcome to you. Let's get straight into the funding. Who specifically pays for this G20 bill now that the show is over?
Yeah, I think that's allocated through various ministries, through the national government, and also obviously cities and provinces taking responsibility for certain infrastructure. In the case of Johannesburg, for certain highways and so on that were refurbished.
Are you confident that there'll be full transparency as far as the bill is concerned?
I think we're hoping that there will be. You know, there's a tradition in South Africa of doing whatever it takes to pull off these events, and then afterwards sort of picking up the pieces. And there was definitely the case with the Soccer World Cup, for example, where the event was spectacular and we pulled it off and everyone thought it was a great World Cup. Mm. But I actually wrote a book about this. It sunk like a lead balloon, Jeremy. Nobody wanted to know about 2010's, you know, what was wrong with 2010. But essentially, you know, from the rigging of building contracts by these building cartels and so on, all the way through to manipulation of match results in the build-up to the World Cup and so on, there was a lot of stuff that went on. I must hasten to add, there's no evidence that any of that has happened with the G20, but we do need to have a transparent account of what happened in the spending and who spent it on what.
Ray, are you concerned that there might have been, before the event then, something of a procurement rush?
I'm not sure. I don't think there is evidence of that. I mean, I think South Africa was pretty well prepared. It's a kind of very orderly process that begins a full year in advance and so on. And I think before that, South Africa knew that it was taking over the presidency from Brazil, at least for many months before, or maybe even a year before the actual handover happened in 2024. So I don't think so. I think it was probably planned for.
Let's talk a little bit about the what we achieved, and let's move away from the process itself. You argue that the big global crises were possibly ignored. What was ignored, and was it just poor strategic planning, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you've got the world's most influential leaders in one room, but you don't discuss the biggest sort of conventional war since the Second World War taking place in Ukraine. You don't discuss the Israel Hamas conflict. And I think that, you know, sort of avoiding those big issues and going for these very soft things that everybody agrees on, and that we all know even before they say anything, they agree on, that there should be sustainable development, that the developing world should be included more in global structures, that, you know, the financing of infrastructure should be easier for countries in Africa and in the developing world. These are important things, but nobody's against them. It's not a major achievement, really, to get everyone on the same page on those things. I think what would have been a major achievement would have been to actually start broadening the discussion of the end of the Ukraine war beyond the US and Russia and their sort of bilateral taking forward of the peace process that's been happening, to the exclusion of Europe, for example.
Is there a suggestion maybe that the absence of the United States made the G20 perhaps politically hollow then?
I think so. I think it's been dismissed, you know, as well. You know, that means the rest of the world can kind of get on without the annoying sort of tantrum in the room, as it were. Mm. But actually, it doesn't really make, you know, if you're reaching climate, you're agreeing on climate things, you're agreeing on industry things, you're agreeing on how financial systems should be Without the US there, love it or hate it, it is the major financial player. And I think also the absence of Xi is quite significant because it is a leaders' summit. And, he has attended all of them except for India. And on that occasion, there was, it was a time where relations with India were pretty stressed. And it was widely viewed as being a statement made by China. And I think in this case, his absence makes a different sort of statement, which is that he kind of takes for South Africa for granted. He doesn't really need to work to get South Africa on side. We're on the team. And it's a slightly diminishes, I think, South Africa's standing somewhat.
So, Ray, when you look at the ledger columns, then, do you think that the presidency of the G20, and this is a final question, damaged or enhanced South Africa's credibility going forward?
I think it enhanced South Africa's credibility on balance because we still managed to pull off the event. And with the leaders that were there, we did get the leaders, the final declaration adopted. But I do think we missed quite a few opportunities.
Ray Hartley from the Platform for African Democrats, thank you very much indeed for that analysis.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as South Africa heads into peak party season, a chilling and worrying trend is starting to emerge. More and more insurance claims are being rejected because drivers were found to be under the influence, sometimes without a blood test ever having been taken. Now, the Ombuds says insurers only need to prove intoxication on, and I quote, "a balance of probabilities," using everything from witness statements to cell phone data and even bank slips. It's a stark reminder, I think, that one bad decision can leave motorists financially exposed for life. Well, I want to look at the rules, the myths, and maybe the risks that many drivers don't seem to understand. And my guest tonight is Idide Teixeira MacKinnon, Lead Ombudsman of the Non-Life Insurance Division at the National Financial Ombudsman. Idide, a very warm welcome to you. I've got to ask myself the question, do we fully, as South Africans, understand that insurers don't need a blood test to prove intoxication? And I would imagine that to an extent, maybe public ignorance is part of the problem that we're going to discuss.
Absolutely correct, Jeremy. I think there is, in a lot of the submissions made by complainants to our office, is that the insurer never obtained. There was never a blood alcohol or breathalyzer test that was conducted on me, and therefore the insurer must settle my claim. There is absolutely the misconception that that is all the insurer needs to rely on to reject a claim on this basis. Not the case. They only need to establish on a balance of probabilities, and they can do that by looking at and providing circumstantial evidence such as witness statements, tracking data, cell phone data, for example, that places you, at a pub, at a shebeen, so in your whereabouts, so creating a case of driving under the influence.
I understand the notion of balance of probabilities, but how do you prevent insurers from abusing the concept when often the evidence can be ambiguous?
So obviously, we look at this evidence very carefully and we call for it ourselves. We are not just going to rely on what an insurer says is the case. We want to listen to the recordings. We want to see the tracking data. We want to see the bank statements. We want to see video footage. Often insurers rely even on that and how the accident happened to build a case. We look and scrutinize all of that evidence. We need to satisfy ourselves that that is indeed what the evidence shows. So often, what we do find is that assessors will ask leading questions of police officials. Instead of asking what was the driver's demeanor, they will, for example, say, "Did the driver have bloodshot eyes? Was the driver unstable on his or her feet? Slurred speech?" So they ask leading questions, and then officers And other witnesses often fall into the trap of saying yes, to support whatever case and whatever agenda they have. And we're not just going to accept that evidence, scrutinize it very carefully. We look at the case law that is applicable in the case. And then once we've satisfied ourselves, we make a decision on a balance of probabilities.
Do you think, given the volume of rejections, we are facing an increasingly serious behavioral problem or an education problem when it comes to drinking and driving, or maybe a combination of the two, probably?
I think it's a combination of the two. In other warnings to consumers, based on the trends that we see, we've often encouraged drivers to use e-hailing services. 10, 15 years back, these weren't available so readily. Or buddy systems. A lot of insurers even encourage a buddy system, or the use of e-hailing services. So it really is, I think, a behavioral thing. And the fact that we've seen an increase in this trend in our office this year, again, for a few years, it wasn't one of the leading trends. It's become again a leading trend. So it's definitely behavioral. And it doesn't matter sometimes how much we try and caution drivers, and based on our cases and what we see in our office, the trend has emerged again, which is very concerning for us and the industry. It also gives the insurance industry, obviously, a bad name. It's already a grudge purchase in the eyes of many consumers. So we try through our communications to play our role, our small role in trying to educate consumers.
How often do you actually overturn insurers' decisions?
So the general overturn rate in the non-life division and in the NFO is around 20%. So in 20% of cases that come before us, we're able to overturn a decision or a stance or, some aspect of the decision in favor of the complaint. But in 80%, no matter how hard we try and look, perhaps to try and assist, we simply can't. We are bound also by the contract, the law, and even when we apply our fairness and equity jurisdiction, there simply aren't grounds to exercise that.
Do you think there's a case to be made that we maybe need to reconsider how insurance exclusions are being communicated, given how devastating a rejected claim can be?
So there's already, several obligations on an insurer to communicate exclusions or circumstances in which benefits will not be paid. That has been incorporated into the policyholder protection rules, which form part of the Insurance Act. There are already a lot of obligations on insurers to bring provisions to policyholders' attention, more so those that are unusual, but driving under the influence is not considered an unusual policy exclusion. It's been in the market for almost as long as policy wordings have been in the market, especially in our market. And one mustn't forget that this isn't only a contractual exclusion or obligation, it is also, a legal requirement that you do not drive whilst you're under the influence of alcohol.
Just a quick one. What's the number one mistake that drivers make after an accident that would result in a rejected claim?
Trying to flee the scene of the accident and providing the insurer with untrue and incomplete information. And those are the two grounds, in fact, that insurers rely on when they can't prove the exclusion of driving under the influence on a balance of probabilities. Often they then fall back onto other provisions in the policy, and they're better able to sustain those rejection reasons than DUI, for example. So there are other ways that insurers can avoid liability in terms of the contract.
Well, you can't say we haven't been warned. Edie Teixeira-McKinnon, thank you very much indeed at the National Financial Ombudsman. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I see the way we work is changing again, and this time it's not about remote flexibility or even hybrid schedules. It's about geography. Workshop 17 and Office Space Company's chief executive, Paul Kirsten, says South Africa's cities are stuck in an outdated system, he says, that forces people into long, punishing commutes when modern urban design offers possibly a better option. The 15-minute city. He argues that moving professional workspace closer to where people actually live could boost productivity, cut carbon, revive urban economies, suburban economies, I guess, and give people their time back. So let's explore this in a little more detail. Paul, a very warm welcome to you. So you suggest the model of work is broken, all well and good, but I wonder if it's a systemic issue or simply just a lifestyle preference for some workers. We like to live perhaps a little more remotely.
Look, I do think it's a systemic issue. And Jeremy, thank you for having me. It is, I think, the thinking of the industrial era that brought us where we are today in the geographical planning, where there's a separation of functions. You live in a place, you work in a very different place, you go out in another different place. And now we see cities gridlocked with traffic. We see people losing a lot of time in traffic. While I think people, and not only a small part, but most people want to lead a more integrated life where they can weave their private life and their work life in a much more integrated way. And I think that's important. Obviously, the second part is the sustainability and the environmental element. The traffic and the exhaust that comes from it, and not only the time, but the pollution, is also not helping making cities very livable. And I think integrating functions that people need in a day in a closer range and a closer distance is actually a logical way of thinking. And if you think of it, you're speaking to a Dutchman. If you look at the old towns in the Netherlands, everything was integrated because we didn't have automobiles, so functions were very close to each other. And I think the automobile made us think that we can get anywhere quite quickly. But now, at the moment, I'm sitting in Cape Town. If you, at this point in the day, want to come from a suburb to Cape Town, you can take an hour or more, which is a loss of time, and it's pollution, and it's traffic.
All right, Paul, let me push you a little further then. Do you have hard evidence that shows proximity alone boosts productivity rather than just convenience?
Look, no, I'll be honest, I don't have it. But if you just simply do the maths of coming into Sandton City or to Cape Town City in the morning somewhere between 7 and 10, will take you 1.5 hours coming from the northern suburbs. And you 1.5 hours back. That's 3 hours that you could use very differently, plus loss of energy. So even though I have not hard data in front of me, it's quite obvious that those 3 hours could be used much more productive.
I guess that makes sense. I'd also come back at you and say, though, that any 15-minute city does require walkability. And given South Africa's crime rates, is your assumption really realistic?
Actually, I think so. I think it could actually help us. If you look at what the approach is to crime prevention and to safety and security, along with separating functions, it has become putting walls in between communities and in between homes and in between buildings, and put a security in front of it. Now, I do think safety, and it's not my idea. If you look at Jeremy Rifkin's work already from 20 years ago, safety is a social concept. So where do you feel safety? I'm sitting at the waterfront now. People walk around, and because people walk around and there's so many eyes, it helps for safety. So safety is a social concept. We're opening next year in Hazelwood in Pretoria, where it started with a few restaurants and a few cafes, and it's become such a vibrant area that's growing, and businesses are coming in, residential is coming in, and people are walking on the street. So instead of separation, again, more integration, bring people together and create visibility. Because if you build a big wall, once you cross the wall, you are not seen by anyone. And many homeowners have unfortunately had that experience. But when you can see each other, you also give less free range to criminal activity, I believe. And I have, when our location in Sandton, across from the Gau train, we had to fight, I'll be honest, with the landlord when he opened, to have a gate onto the pavement that people could walk in and out. And we had that for 8 years now, and I think we had 3 little incidents in 8 years' time. So I think the fear also prevents us from really connecting with each other, which could actually increase safety.
Paul, do you think the shift to local workspaces, as you're suggesting, also risks hollowing out central business districts, which in this country, and particularly I'm thinking about Johannesburg, are already under pressure?
Yes, and I think it needs us to rethink what a business district is and if it should be just about business. If you go to a business district in Johannesburg, apart from Sandton City, but outside of Sandton City, in the weekend it's dead. So there's no life and vibrancy. And what we're seeing happening, that some companies come in and repurpose offices into apartments and living space. So bringing life back into a CBD that is not only a CBD, but a central district where you can live, where you can work, and where you can shop or go out. And I think that's what a Sandton needs to become more of, instead of 20 years of thinking, oh, we can make money with commercial property, let's put another office building. And at some point you forget what a fabric is that an area needs to be sustainable and alive and safe.
Do you think there is a danger of the 15-minute office model becoming just premium co-working spaces for the affluent, and you're simply not thinking about support staff who are going to battle to get there?
That is a great question, and it's the one I'm battling with. I'll be very honest on that. And we are actually exploring with the city of Cape Town to see where we can put a Workshop 17 in the township, in the Cape Flats. Because there, I think the need is as big to create a social and a work hub where people can come and flourish and develop their careers and their businesses without having to commute in a taxi for an hour and a half. We're trying to convince companies to say, well, if we put a Workshop 17 there, can you not make your staff work there instead of having them to come into the city? Because apart from time and pollution, for them, it's a big part of the salary. Mm. So can we also reduce their cost of commute? And it's something we are trying to work out. It's not easy. I won't lie and I won't pretend that I know the answers. But it's something I'm really, really passionate about, seeing if we can make that work.
Well, you certainly have raised the debate. Paul Kirsten, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, Workshop 17. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.